they have to be properly electronically configured so that the, at the right amplitude and phase, we're pumping power back into LIPA or Con Ed. My guess is it's going to be a brand new design effort for inexpensive chunks of electronics. They probably already exist that can do that kind of work. Back to you on that one, Glenn, for some comments. K2LIW in the TechNet.
WB2HW, you know what you see?
How we recognized? Glenn, go ahead.
Yeah, it's fantastic what's going on in Europe, especially with those kinds of power backup things. But here again in the States, we've got quite a few interesting programs going on. There's one right here on Long Island with LIPA, where you can actually, they will, with an offset course, that you can actually start, you know, you have to pay it up front initially. The system, you can put the solar cells up on the roof and connect it up. They'll connect you up with a special meter that will communicate back, so when you're selling electricity back to LIPA and when you're drawing it back in. So you can actually contact LIPA for more information on that, and they can give you the different kits and availabilities of what's there. I also have one more comment, Dick. Let me just let the repeater drop. Yeah, the other thing was just a quick note is that a typical switching power supply, if you take a switching power supply that has an output LC filter, dominant pole, that's somewhere around 1 to 5 kilohertz, and if you were to adjust the reference voltage to a 60-cycle sine wave, you can basically recreate a DC sine wave, basically going from 0 to whatever the peak voltage of the power supply is, to that output voltage at basically 60 cycles, no problem. A typical feedback loop inside a power supply is usually around 250 microseconds to sort of recreate an 8 or 10 millisecond you know, response in the output of the power supply is relatively easy. Back over to you, Dan.
I think what you're describing is sometimes called a cycloconverter. Is that true, Glenn?
Yes, it is. It's just the only reason why I wanted to bring that up is because initially everyone was thinking that if you just had to do, if you have a generator and if you have to have batteries and other things in between to give yourself an electronic output, that's just one easy way of doing it. And then coupling with just a capacitor on the output or some other, you know, you could use a transformer device or something else. And there are also a whole bunch of other techniques where you can basically just take a squaring output of a generator and pretty much just use electronics and basically clip it up at 100 kilohertz sample at varying pulse widths and just filter it with an LC filter on the output, and it basically recreates a very beautiful sine wave.
It sounds like you're going to be seeing more and more of those as time goes on. Next person who signed in was Joe, W82RYY. I'll get it eventually right, Joe. You got it, Joe.
I wasn't listening. Hi, Dick. W2RY here. I wasn't listening to the entire conversation, but I heard you talk about different types of tuned circuits. I guess I think that's what we basically was the subject. Is that correct?
We covered a whole lot of subjects, but you're allowed to put in any information you want or ask whatever you want. You got it, Joe.
Okay, here's a question. I don't know what the answer is. Maybe you've heard of it. Maybe you haven't. It's in regards to what's called, I think it's called, the title is called the Shelby-Chev filter. And in a particular application of a mobile radio, they use these type of filters in, say, a low band, for example, which basically gives you a block of frequencies it'll pass fairly easily and give you pretty steep rejection once you start going 1 or 2 megs out of the band limits, the upper low band limits. In particular, I'm talking about a radio that operates between 42 to 50. And you can get the VCO to operate above the band. You can program it to put 52, 53 meg frequencies in, for example, but the front end has terrible sensitivity then. The question I'm curious of is, the fix for this was putting pieces of aluminum wire in the coil forms, which have no slugs in them at all. And as you take a signal generator and put it on frequency, you might get a very, very bad sensitivity, 20, 30, 50, maybe 100 microvolts at 52, 53 meg compared to normal 0.5 or 0.25 at between 42 to 50. And as you lower the aluminum wire into each particular slug, you'll see the sensitivity increase dramatically, and you can basically obtain the same sensitivity that the filter is designed between 42 to 50. You can obtain it 53 meg or 52 meg. Can you explain what the phenomenon is going on here? Because the aluminum apparently is not, you know, like a ferrite type of material. So I'm a bit of a loss of why this is doing this.
Okay, you may have come to the right place. First of all, it's called Chebyshev. It's a Russian mathematician who invented a class of filters that are very popular. Butterworth and Chebyshev filters, you look at those two sets of words in the index of the reference data for radio engineers, and I think that book is now up to the 8th or 9th edition. You'll see a whole chapter on that subject. If you and I took a single resonator, LC circuit, and properly couple it, we'll get a certain shape of the passband. Put two resonators together and couple them just correctly as far as loading and coupling between the two, you'll get a sharper curve with a flatter top. Put three, four, or five resonators together, and you can make what's called a brick wall filter, which means it's got a very steep skirt at the low end, a nice flat top of response across a significant number of megacycles, and another steep skirt on the high end. The whole idea of a Chebyshev filter is that if you design it just right, you get the sharpest possible filtering for those particular resonators you put together when you have them coupled just right together. The flat top region is going to have a little bit of ripple to it, peak to valley they call it. As you allow the ripple in that center section to get higher, you get steeper skirts. As you force the center section ripples to go to zero, instead of being called Chebyshev, it's called Butterworth, the smooth filter, Butterworth you can call it, and then the skirts become a little bit floppier. Okay. Each individual resonator, which is an air core coil, let me drop. Back in the old days, IF cans and similar coils, RF coils, you would have a tuning stick, usually it's a plastic wand, where it was a ferrite chunk on one end and a brass chunk on the other end. When you put the ferrite inside of the air coil, you're adding extra magnetic material, increasing its mu, and the coil went to a lower frequency. When you pull that slug out on that tuning tool and put in the other end that had the brass slug, and you put that inside the air core coil, the coil would go to a higher frequency. You're creating a magnetic shunt. Even though you haven't made contact, there normally is magnetic field going down the center of a solenoid coil. You put a conducting material in there, brass, aluminum, copper, whatever, conducting non-magnetic material. You are shorting out some of the magnetic field that normally flows down the center. That's the equivalent of shorting out one of the turns of the coil. Therefore, the coil moves up in frequency. So each chunk of aluminum rod you put down each air coil is moving that coil to a higher frequency. And if you do it just right on all of those coils simultaneously to the right magnitude, you've got a brand new Chebyshev filter with the exact same shape. But instead of it going from, we'll say, 42 to 50, you could make it tune 45 to 55. I think you see the principle. It's an A2RYY, A2RYW. Good question.
Mr. Leotic.
Rich recognized after...
gave you a minor point of order.
Okay, point of order. Go ahead.
If you're looking up Chebyshev in any kind of a book, it might be spelled with a CH or a TSCH. But the main thing is the amount of ripple in a Chebyshev filter is intimately related to the steepness of the skirt. That's what makes it a Chebyshev. The skirt seat, the steeper the skirts, the more ripple you're going to have. Back to Dick.
Okay, good to know. And when you ask the ripple to go to zero across the passband, they call it Butterworth. And a very similar set of equations. And when you plug in the right numbers into that equation, you can predict exactly what the filter is going to do ahead of time. Rich, N2EO, go ahead.
Vic, you touched on it with the brass slugs. The best way to tune that up is to put it on a sleep generator, and if those coils have threads in them, you can put whatever size screw we need to bring the brass through, 632, whatever you might need to get it to made up with the threads, and you can adjust it with a tuning wand, and with a sleep generator, you can get just what he wants.
Yeah, sleep generator, network analyzer, a lot of instruments nowadays you can get your hands on, Joe, that'll help you do that tuning. The fact that the curve moves up in frequency but ends up ugly when you put a slug in one of the coils or two of the coils, don't let that upset you. Until you put slugs in, aluminum slugs or brass slugs, into all of the coils, the right side slugs with the right amount of penetration, until you do all of them simultaneously, you will not walk the whole filter with that beautiful bandpass shape up to your desired frequency. But now that what you're looking for, that's going to help a lot. I know that Howie wanted to say some comments on either this or the previous subject. Howie, HWW, go right ahead, KQLIW.
Dick, I wanted to ask a question. I was earlier talking about antennas with low SWR. Now, I just want to clarify something so I understand this. Are you saying that if you are able to get the SWR low enough so that you have a super low return loss, you are then able to use a hybrid circuit where you can put a transmitter and receiver into the same place, and if you have enough shielding, you will be able to receive and transmit in duplex on the same frequency without using filters? Is that what you're really saying, that if you use a hybrid circuit, almost like a telephone line, you can send a signal down the transmission line to the antenna, and as long as you have a low enough return loss, that you'll be able to duplex on that same frequency? Is that what I'm understanding?
Absolutely. I know it sounds like bootstrapping. I know it sounds crazy, Howie. With all the courses you and I took, we were told that that's impossible. Well, impossible ain't impossible anymore. The exotic way to do it is to make the VISWR of the antenna extremely low, or make the S11 voltage reflection coefficient. That's what S11 is in the scattering matrix talk of a network analyzer. Make that low enough, like minus 30, minus 35, minus 40 dB, and we're talking about numbers like 1.03 standing wave ratio here. You make that low enough, you can transmit and receive on the exact same antenna simultaneously, no filtering. A hybrid is one way to do it. I'm doing it with a simple directional coupler. The directional coupler is looking for the signal coming back from the antenna, and that goes into the receiver. The directional coupler is primarily rejecting the signal that flows in the forward path toward the antenna from the transmitter. So these RFID readers, transmitter receiver setup, full duplex CW operation, transmitting and receiving, same frequency, simultaneously, same antenna, no filtering. Ain't that a mind blower? Back to you, Howie.
Now the next question is this. Well, what happens if the signal goes out the antenna and hits some object and comes back to you, a bounce or reflection? Isn't that going to cause a problem? If that's not going to be caused by the matching of the antenna, a signal goes out the antenna and then propagation. Now, is this only good for CW type or data communication, or can you run a full duplex telephone link point to point and use a single channel and do it in the analog mode, or does this have to be in some fancy digital technology where the receiver has enough intelligence to know that this was the same signal that went out and I'm going to ignore it because it's coming back, and to saying, well, this is the same packet of data that I sent out, so I will neglect this or I'll ignore this? Well, can you run a full analog signal point to point and do it on the same frequency if you get down far enough in return loss?
Boy, do I have good news for you. I've been doing it now for 3 years. Full analog. Doesn't have to be digital. Full analog. And by the way, the object you put out in front of the antenna is giving you a reflection. Theoretically, you're absolutely right. It's disturbing the apparent standing wave ratio of the antenna. However, you get 31 dB of loss at 915 megacycles, free space air loss, in the first 3 feet. So if I put a small sheet of metal out in front of the antenna, 3 feet away, the signal coming out of the antenna is attenuated 31 dB, free space, to get to the sheet of metal. It reflects off the sheet of metal and another 31 dB of free space loss before it comes back to your antenna. Now, depending on the gain of your antenna and the so-called reflection gain of the sheet of metal, if it's big enough and parabolic in shape and whatever, that can still screw you up. But in general, as long as that sheet of metal is more than 3 or 4 feet away, it doesn't stop this full analog operation. Doesn't that give you ideas? Back to you, Howie.
Point-to-point communications and say frequency space run on the same channel. And you don't have to worry about filters. Now, the only thing you have to worry about is weather conditions, or you have electronic tuning to keep the SWR down as things change. Because if you let's say I was going to run a link from New York to Connecticut or New York to your house, let's say 900 megs or even a 1.2, and we were going to use the same frequency, if our antennas are outside, we're going to get variations in SWR, but I assume we can have a microprocessor monitor that through the directional coupler and keep the antennas in tune, and that we could, well, basically, it means we can save frequency space. You don't need two frequencies, and you don't need a duplexing cavity. Am I correct in what I am analyzing here?
90% correct, Howie. Bear in mind now, when you're reading an RFID tag, a thoroughly passive tag, rarely is a tag ever more than 15 or 20 feet away. So therefore, the amount of free space loss to the tag and back are not these huge numbers you're going to get when you talk to somebody 100 miles away. When you're talking 100 miles away, well, I take it back. The tag is two-way. It's like a radar. Whereas 100 miles away, you're talking to the other guy's receiver. Yes, you can do it. The only catch is that in the case of reading an RFID tag, usually it is 1 watt of power you're allowed to transmit, maximum. 6 dB of antenna gain you're allowed to use, maximum. So that 4 watts of effective radiated power is the maximum the FCC will allow you on a non-licensed RFID reader. So 4 watts is going out. The tag is absorbing, reflecting, and sending it back to you. At the proper range, you're reading the tag signal at something like minus 80 dBm. So minus 80 coming back, plus 36 going out, that's, if I got the numbers right, I think it's 116 dB of dynamic range. Whereas when you and I are running the kind of operation we run, let me drop, we'd like to transmit 100 watts of power, we'd like to receive a quarter of a microvolt of signal. So you and I are talking more in the 140, 150 dB of dynamic range. Now, can you get 140 or 150 dB of dynamic range with this F1 full duplex analog? I think the answer is yes, but you hit on a good subject when you said there'd have to be some automatic tuning to make that happen. And the answer is yes, the technology is now there to do that. Guarantee it's going to give you some ideas, Howie. Back to you. I can tell you're starting to breathe, Abby. K2LIW.
I've been out of the field too long. It's just showing me that I'm an old horse in a race. No, seriously, no. It's just something I was thinking about when you were talking about that. I said, wow, the technology, because I read about some of this stuff on the Internet. Okay, that's all I wanted to ask, basically, is that now you can run a repeater on the same frequency. You don't have to worry about, you don't have to have filters to attenuate the other frequency. You just basically have to, basically, it's almost like a phone line. You have to have enough isolation in the forward. Basically, what you're running is a hybrid network, a hybrid system of some sort that your forward signal doesn't bother the other signal coming back, basically.
You've got it, Howie. The technology is there. This is one place where the ham radio operators didn't do it first. But maybe they're going to do it a little bit later and do it a little bit better. I can see it coming. And the first one's going to be installed on a 29 megacycle F1 repeater. When you transmit and receive on the same frequency, the industry coined a set of words a whole lot of years ago on a modification of this. They called it an F1 repeater system. But you're talking about an F1 duplex communication system. And the technology is there. I didn't say it's easy, but since all these RFID readers are to some degree doing it now, and it's a so-called direct conversion receiver, zero IF receiver, that's doing it. You'd be amazed how simple the receiver is and how sophisticated the results are once you know what you're doing. And then the next step with this jazz is that you can start modulating the signals in exotic ways that when it echoes back to you, you recognize the time delay of the modulation, and you're doing direction finding and ranging. Oh, you can have a grand old time. It is a CW radar. Continuous analog CW radar. That's what an RFID reader is. But if you look at the sections of the Skolnick radar handbook under CW radar, you'll see a little bit of this jazz. They didn't carry it far enough. They didn't have the modern circuitry. They didn't have the sophisticated people, it says here, designing antennas with extremely low standing wave ratio across a band of frequencies, not just at one frequency. Well, that's what's required in order to do this frequency hopping that you must do in order to meet the FCC rules for a non-licensed piece of equipment. Anybody with any further questions on this, and it should be some, K2RIW in the deck man.
Another question. What you're saying is that if you have enough smarts in your reader, the reader could say, oh, the ID tag is 6 feet from me, and you could actually have a robot find the item in the store because it would know how far it is from the transmitting unit.
Give that man a cigar. The biggest problem they have in warehouses, Howie, is where's my stuff? 2 months ago, somebody on a forklift piled a box, three boxes back on shelf number 45, and it's perishable equipment, and it's going out of date. And by barcode, how the hell do you find that box when it's three boxes back on the shelf? You properly program a handheld RFID reader, and you say, I'm looking for tag number 451307. You walk up and down the aisle with that reader in your hand, and pretty soon it beeps at you and says, there it is. It's off to your right at a 45-degree angle, and it's 13.5 feet away from you. And pretty soon you realize, hey, it's the second box back on that shelf. It's hidden behind that other box. No wonder I didn't see that. And you find your perishable equipment. There's a hell of a lot of loss that happens in warehouses that are not extremely well run because they lose track of perishable equipment, and ordinary barcodes don't allow them to find it, but an RFID tag does allow them to find it, because the RF is transparent to many of the contents of those boxes, and it can read things that you cannot see. Do you see the power of that? Over to you, Howie, K2LIW.
Good and bad of it. The good is you can find stuff. The bad is if you would, I'm not going to get into conspiracies, but if you wanted to, you could find out where people are. You could find out how far they are from something if they're carrying a passport. But you need a lot of power. I just made a comment. But yes, I could see that medical equipment, other things, some areas where you need to keep tabs on special medicines. You could say, oh, that's that. This, you could have a grid and know where exactly is in a building.
In the case of a passport, they've already solved that problem, Howie. You put the passport in its case. The case is a new metal shield or a metal shield, so the tag becomes inoperative. So you can make the tag shut up by putting it, the tag that's on your passport. You fold up the passport, put it in the case, and no longer can it be read. So that's not as bad of a problem as you think. Also, there's ways of by the way you address the tag, you can make it only respond when it sees a very particular code. Other than that, it doesn't talk. And that can be a quasi-secret, so to speak. And there's a whole series of techniques for making the tag active and inactive when you want it to be. Back to you, Ali.
Yeah, I was reading articles about security that thieves can get information. But no, seriously, a lot of good stuff. Okay, I'm going to let you guys get back to where you are, but you piqued my interest previously, and it shows how far behind the times I am. WD2HWW.
You're only a couple of months behind, Howie. This hasn't been going on that long. Anybody with any further questions or comments on any of the above, or even a new subject, give us your call letters and name right now. K2LIW, my name is Dick.
RSO again. WW.
Okay, RSO and WW in that order. Frank first, go ahead.
Okay, good. follow-up to our conversation earlier on the generators with the inverted technology. I'm on the Honda webpage right now, and they have their claims of benefits of these generators. And the first of which is that it's super quiet, and looking about 53 to 59 dBA. From experience, I'm actually able to run the generator and carry on a conversation with someone approximately 50 feet away without shouting. Let me just read the statement of Honda Inverted Technology. This is their claim. By taking the raw power produced by the generator and passing it through a special microprocessor, Honda generators are able to produce a sine wave equal to or better than your household power. This means you can even operate the most sensitive electronics without fear of interruption. Well, that's a pretty strong claim, Vic. And I believe they only make it to two powers now. They're 2,000 watt, which I have, and the 3,000 watt with inverted technology. But as Mel mentioned, it seems like manufacturers are going to start raising the power and using this inverted technology for just about everything. Back to you, Dick. This is N2RS overriding.
Yeah, that Honda generator that's making power that's that pure, I think they're doing it by what could be called cycloconverter. You could also call it direct digital synthesizer. Usually a direct digital synthesizer with a lookup table and a clock and a digital to analog converter is step-by-step reconstructing a RF sine wave. In this case, you're with very fine steps reconstructing a 60 cycle sine wave with high purity. So I think it's a kind of direct digital synthesizer without being called that. Do you somewhat agree with that, Frank? And by the way, Frank, your rodeo is nice and clean, but it's half the volume I think it should be. Back to you, Frank.
Okay, Dick. Well, the wife is sleeping. I'm trying not to talk. That's too loud. Yeah, that sounds pretty logical at this point. By the way, the other benefit of this generator, and by the way, I don't own stock in the company. I have no pecuniary interest at all. The weight of this particular kilowatt job is only 46.3 pounds. You add gas to it, and it goes up a little bit, but definite benefits to it. Back to you, Dick.
And Frank, how expensive is that beautiful beast?
Okay, the list price is rather high. Manufacturers recommended retail price is $1,079.95. So we're talking about $1,080. If you look at USD, you'll find almost every issue in the back. There's an ad from a company called Mayberry, and they said for ARRL members, their price is $8.79, which is a big drop from the retail price. Probably find some places that have it cheaper, but that seems to be the best in this area. Thank you.
Yeah, I think, Frank, you just solved a major problem among the microwave people. When they run traveling wave tubes on mountaintop operations from a portable gasoline power generator, and they run into all this power supply false alarm problem, that built-in pure inverter sounds like a beautiful way to go. Fantastic. Alrighty. The next person who wanted to talk, why in the world did I not write down his name? You know who you are. Go ahead.
Thanks, Dick. WW2WW. I've been a little bit interested lately on infrasound. I've been reading a little bit lately where the Nazis used it to agitate the crowds during the Madman session. And I was also reading about how infrasonic waves can carry over long distances and are, of course, less susceptible to disturbance or interference at higher frequencies. I hear you are I've been listening to you for quite some time, and I see that you guys are very interested in high-frequency work. I was wondering where the infrasound portion of waves come in the door of radio technology, if at all it does, and if there is any kind of new breakthroughs in infrasound technology as compared to amateur radio or radio frequency itself. I just wanted you to maybe just touch on that. I'm not looking for like 2 hours of expose on it, but definitely whatever you can give me, I would appreciate it. www.
Okay, Frank, you told me to be brief, and the answer is yes. That was a joke. When it comes to very low subaudible sounds to a human hearing system, elephants are known to use that, and they communicate with each other over very long distances. Radio-wise, super low frequencies, VLF, ULF, ultra-low frequencies, have been used, numbers like 17 kilohertz, 4 kilohertz, I think even 50 hertz, numbers like that, have been used for transmitting RF energy. The advantage of going so low in frequency is that the ionosphere and Earth becomes a piece of waveguide, and if you transmit enough power at those low frequencies, you can talk to a submarine, even though it's 60 feet and more below seawater, below the surface of the seawater, anywhere in the world. It's called the command receiver. They recently abandoned it, I think, because they've got satellite and other better systems. But for a lot of years, our nuclear submarine fleet were being communicated to by way of these super low frequencies. And it's kind of hard for you and I to call, I'm going to pick a number, 50 hertz and RF frequency. But if you've got a big enough antenna and you put enough wattage into it, that signal will penetrate. The skin depth in seawater is a real big number, and it gets down to your submarine and talks to them no matter where they are in the world. So super low audio in air and acoustic waves, and what you and I would call very low, ultra low frequencies in RF, they have definite benefits. The V spectrum, what you're talking about, the audio spectrum, radio spectrum, optical spectrum, infrared, ultraviolet, really is. We used to call it DC to light, and now I call it DC to cosmic ray. It's all the same continuous spectrum, and if you know how to use each little portion of it, they've all got their advantages. Back to you, Tim.
How does it affect the whales?
Not at all. If you know how much heroic electronics you have to build to listen to that super weak signal that's talking to that submarine, very, very, RF-wise, not a problem. Now, when it comes to a sonar system, the high-power, high-resolution, conformal phased array sonar systems that are on various nautical pieces of instrumentation, you know, submarines and destroyers and whatever, yes. That sonar system, there is ample evidence that that sometimes does do damage to the hearing system of a whale that's nearby. And so I think there is now circuitry installed on these sonars that can recognize the echo of a whale and therefore not transmit high-power acoustic signals in that direction so as to not damage the hearing system if the whale happens to move in close. I think they are applying that kind of a countermeasure. Back to you, Tim. Wait for the beep, KQRIW.
Okay, that's fascinating. I found this interesting, the infrasound technology very interesting, and just was wondering where that brought us as far as our reference is concerned. I appreciate that. It's a good start. I'm still doing a little bit more of studying on it, and definitely chock full of information. Appreciate you. www.
I'm a little curious, Tim. What would you like to do with infrasound? And you're talking about acoustic infrasound, I presume.
Well, I've been reading a little bit how infrasound was studied with weaponry and different things like that, and I was just kind of curious if that's something that is still going on. And it just fascinated me. They're also using it for, to give you better feeling, to help your... Yeah, look at the words getting late. I'm getting ready for bed. Just to give you an overall better feeling.
In other words, if you If you make subaudible music, I'm going to get a warm, fuzzy feeling just before I go to sleep, and I'll be happier and sleep better. Is that sort of the idea here, Tim?
Affirmative.
Sounds good to me. There's a pun there somewhere. I'll drink to that. Okay. You guys have listened to TechNet number 1194. I wonder if there's any further questions or comments we should say to each other before we close down tonight. If so, give me your call letters right now.
K2YO, Bernie.
Go ahead, Bernie.
Back to your discussion about RFID tags, and give the example of having a box that got stashed away behind some other boxes in a warehouse, and you were saying that RFID would let you identify that that box is in your warehouse. I'm just curious, what do they need to be able to locate where in the warehouse that box is?
Okay, the way it's done now, for the few people that are properly equipped, is that you know that every major box in the warehouse has got an RFID tag. You know that the missing box that has this perishable equipment is tag number 45. You take a handheld reader, which has a range up to 20 feet. You program that handheld reader to find tag number 45. You walk up and down the aisles of your warehouse, and when you get within 20 feet of that box, your handheld reader starts beeping at you and says, "Hey, Bernie, there it is. It's off to the right, 45 degrees, and it's 17.5 feet from you." Back to you, Bernie.
Okay, now you just opened up another question. So basically, they're sniffing it until you get close enough to it. The example you just gave, how does it know it's at 45 degrees?
Because I designed the antenna that sits on the front of your handheld reader. That antenna has got an 80-degree beam width. You squish the reader back and forth until the field strength meter on the display of your reader says, aha, that's where it geeks up. That's one way to do it. There are other ways. Back to you, Bernie.
Hi, okay, that's what I was looking for. I was just curious how they would find this warehouse is pretty big, and going to look for, you know, knowing that things out there is one thing, but that's fine. Anyway, thanks for all the good.
On top of that, Bernie, if you spend enough money and if you've got enough infrastructure in your warehouse, you've got a whole lot of fixed antennas scattered throughout the warehouse that are connected by coax cables to readers or individual readers on those antennas, and you can do automatic inventory. In other words, at 2 o'clock in the morning, the system turns itself on, and it literally by your scattering of readers and antennas throughout the warehouse, it finds all the stuff and finds out what's in the warehouse right now. So that's one approach. I've also worked on a technique where the reader would automatically tell you 45 degrees to the right without you aiming it like a flashlight. I will admit, though, that that technique is a little bit elaborate, a little bit expensive, and it's not likely to become a product for a while. But there is a need for that. For the time being, using the reader as a flashlight, and that particular flashlight can see through boxes, that in itself, to many people, is good enough. Thank you for any further questions, Bernie.
No, I think you got it covered.
Anybody have any further questions or comments? Give me your call letters and name right now.
K2KEY.
Hey, you're supposed to be sleeping, old man. You're older than me. You're tireder than me. Go ahead, Mel.
Actually, Dick, I can kind of put things away because I have so much stuff here all over the place. I can say stuff in the driveway. I'm running in and out, but listening with the handy talkie, and also in the house I had a lot of electrical stuff, rigs, you name it, so I just had to get things, you know, put away one piece at a time. Something very interesting I did see, Glenn was just mentioning about power supplies and all. He showed me a very interesting project that he built. He built a kilowatt HF amplifier for the mobile, and he's using a switching system that he designed and built. Very clever. I'm looking at it. Very, very nice job that he did on this
kilowatt amplifier for the mobile, and because he was using, he is using 48 volt transistors in it. And I asked him, I said to him, when he mentioned, because I happen to have some of those modules, you know, that use 48 volt transistors and RF modules at 150 watts. And I was saying to him, I said, where are you getting the 48 volts in a mobile? And he designed a very interesting, very compact switching supply that takes his 12 volts and gives him a 48 volt tickover.
I guess that's a voltage quadrupler of a kind. And it's probably done with a toroid transformer running at 100 kc and a synchronous demodulator. Yeah. Synchronous demodulator, synchronous rectifier, and there are some good hex FET type transistors out there that have on resistance that are milliohms, off resistance that are megohms, switching rates that are good almost to a megacycle and beyond. There's fancy kinds of ferrite and toroids that can do that, the right kind of winding techniques, the right kind of ceramic bypass capacitors. The technology is there. Not super expensive, and you ain't seen nothing yet. So, how long is it going to be before you have one of these, Mel?
I had a kilowatt rig years ago in there, and I was describing it to him. And, of course, that was ancient history using, you know, 4X250, pair of them in the amplifier in the trunk. And, well, I don't know, let's see, is Glenn still on frequency, KT2QIQ? Could you elaborate a little bit more on it? This is KT2QIQ.
And he might be, may have found out, was it a Lise Nivelle generator that was generating all that steam and a fancy belt going to the drive shaft of your automobile? Go ahead.
Okay, well, my system, yes, was using a Lise Nivelle, a double-belted alternator, and of course, installed in that car, it's basically the Lise Nivelle. I meant to describe them to those who are not familiar with it. It was basically made for ambulance and fire trucks, and all where you needed really lots and lots of power. I had selenium rectifiers, of course. The output on the top of the Lise Nivelle had a bunch of terminals on top for three-phase output, and what I had was made a transformer that gave me 2,000 volts, which was also mounted underneath the hood, and I sent the 2,000 volts back to the trunk with wires that ran under. I used actually ignition wire, solid copper ignition wire because of the insulation factor. And that was my power supply source. So I now was very interested in, you know, putting possibly, again, it sort of piqued my interest again. And I wanted to know how he's doing it with the regular alternator, Dick, and a very clever system that he built over.
When it comes to that three-phase transformer that gave you 2,000 volts, and the nice thing about three-phase, when it's properly rectified, you get very little ripple, and your capacitors don't have to work anywhere near as hard. A three-phase, full-wave three-phase gives you 6 pulses per cycle, per revolution, so to speak. And that's a very nice waveform to work with. Did you wind that transformer yourself, Mel? Because that sounds like a very special product. Also, my guess is there was some kind of a major relay that connected it and disconnected it to the Lise Nivelle, because when the engine was idling and Lise Nivelle is turning slowly, it's running at a low, very low frequency, and that very low frequency, I think, could saturate your transformer. Back to you, Mel.
Yeah, I had a number of indicators. Of course, you know, we're going back ancient history. You didn't have any microprocessing of any sort. So there was no chips around in those days. So you watched your indicator. I had few meters on the front panel there. You can do it with those cars. This is a 60 Chevrolet Impala convertible that I had at the Super Sports car. So you could get away with all these things. There was a lot of room in that car, under the hood especially. Now, the transformer, yes, was specially wound by a friend of mine that worked for a transformer company here in Brooklyn. They used to make transformers, believe it or not, in Brooklyn. And gave him the, told him what I wanted, and he was able to come up with one. Very clever how they put it together and all, and was one of an only, really. Sorry, I really dumped it. I dumped all that. I had all that stuff laying around. When I pulled it out of the car, I got rid of the car. The amplifier basically stripped essentially for something else. But it was a very, you know, interesting concept, how I could say the least, about work with selenium rectifiers, basically. I guess even that maybe sort of passe. I don't think you see any seleniums around anymore, Dick, over.
Way back in the late 60s, early 70s, I needed, I forget the number now, I think it was 5,000 volts, to run the cathode grade tube on an oscilloscope display for a spectrum analyzer. I needed a special high voltage transformer, a custom winding. I went to a transformer winding company in Brooklyn named Ed Coe. And Mr. Coe, I can't think of his first name, was the president of the company. Sure would be a coincidence that that was the company that wound the transformer for you. Back to you, Mel.
Same as Eddie Foley. And that's the man. He was a, basically, that was his engineering skill. He studied, and he had all kinds of charts. He had in his files thousands and thousands of transformer designs from all different companies and places that the people wanted. He, let's put it this way, Dick. He was the Peter Dahl of yesteryear, over.
Okay, it might not be the same guy. The guy I'm talking about now was, his last name was Coe, C-O-E. His son was Robert Coe, who I worked with, and the father's name could have also been Robert, I'm not sure. And Ed Coe Electronics was the name of the transformer winding company. I think you said Cohen. It may not be Coe. May not be the same guy, but maybe they knew about each other. Go ahead.
Well, Ed Coe, Ed, he actually owned the operation. His son was the manager. The chief engineer was a fellow by the name of Eddie Edward Poland. He was the P-O-L-A-N-D, Poland. He was the chief engineer. He actually did the transformer design. It had that little factory, broken down factory type building here in Brooklyn, in the industrial section. And they were making, I can say, they were the Peter Dahl of the of yesteryear. It was, yeah, they had thousands of designs of, you know, so if you wanted a transformer, replace the transformer for a piece of equipment, one and only, sometimes it was a little hard to buy one and only, they'd make it for you, Dick, even if you had a design of your own, or they would design it for you. Of course, all e-lamination transformers, so they didn't have anything really that was exotic like hyperseal transformers, Dick, over.
And these transformers that we were buying were encased in some kind of a brown-looking epoxy material. I also have my 2,000-volt power supply for my 4CX250B amplifier. It's one of those transformers. Not encapsulated, though, this one. EI lamination. Huh. It's quite possible you and I went to the same guy. And as I said, I was dealing with them between roughly 1969 and 1975. They were still producing that product beyond that, but I was no longer associated with that division. Roughly what year were you doing this? Let's see now. A Chevrolet Impala convertible in Brooklyn. I can see that's the kind of a vehicle where you drive up to the middle of the town, you open the door, you wait till the car is filled up with ladies, and then you drive off. Is that what those guys did in Brooklyn? Back to you, Mel.
And that and a lot of other things. Yeah, I'm getting a look already. I can't comment on this. This is why you got to have eyeballs. USO 6. The, yeah, it was a 1960 Chevrolet Impala. Oh, boy, what a car that was. With a white body, black top, red interior. In fact, the car still exists. The guy, second person that I sold it to one guy, he sold to another guy, and now it's at the antique car show. I go every door antique car show at Fort Denham, and there's just my old Chevy convertible. But the, yeah, Ed Coe, his last name was not Coe, his last name was Coe, Colbert, I believe, Ed Colbert, if I'm not mistaken. He just shortened it down to Ed Cole. In other words, the first name was Ed. And they were making, I could say, you know, all that stuff there. What you're talking about is the potting. Oh, he had a... he couldn't get away with that today. That potting business when they're cooking and baking and all that stuff. That potting really... That thing, when it was ruined, when they did potting, you could smell it a half a block away over.
And nowadays, those noxious fumes would be considered objectionable. Okay, I think we've gone far enough, unless you have some further suggestions. We could call it a night. You've had quite a day, sir. Back to you, Mel.
You know, in fact, what put him out of business, really, you just had hit it. It's the, not the, so much even the smell, I guess you could have filtered that, but they used to wash a lot of chemicals that they used in the process of making these things, these transformers, and they wash it down the sewer system. Along came the EPA eventually, closed all these places down. You got to dispose of those chemicals, and it became too costly, over.
It's too bad that a auxiliary industry didn't come along fast enough that could collect those chemicals and find a good place to dispose of them, or a good way of disposing them. Nowadays, I don't think it has to be expensive, but in those days, moving toxic chemicals were very difficult. Nobody had yet established that industry. And another thing I guess happened is that if you were dumping it into your sewer system for the last 20 years, and now you're suddenly required to clean up all of that contaminated soil, your easiest thing is to go out of business because the total cost of doing that, I guess, would bury you. Back to you, Mel.
But they were flushing it down the city sewer system, not into a you know, a septic system or anything. It was the city sewer system that it was going down. So they cut all those places. Now, in that area where he had the plant, next door to him, in fact, I knew the guy next door to him because he had done also some nice work for us. He was a plater. He used to plate metal, copper plate, brass plate, chrome plate, all that stuff. He too had to go out of business because also that copper sulfate and everything they used, they stopped them from flushing it down the city sewer system. So to take it away, it was too costly. They that whole industry over there was all, you know, transformers, plating businesses, and all kinds of businesses that were disposing of their waste down the city sewer system, and they all were stopped, so they all went out of business, Dick, over.
And give me the name of the district, town, couple of cross streets where this is located. Next time I run into his son, I want to mention that to him. So roughly, where was this industrial area you're describing now? Go ahead.
Actually, it was it's part of what they call Red Hook area of Brooklyn. Some of them call it the Bush Terminal Industrial Park. It is now still an industrial park. Of course, it was a very active area, you know, during World War II. God knows what came out of that area, you know, tremendous amounts of manufacturing. They had huge warehouses, you know, Brooklyn Army Terminal is not far away. And Bush Terminal, those buildings are still being utilized. Phenomenally way they built those buildings, every one of them, that can withstand instant amounts of weight on any floor because made for heavy machinery use. You know, they built actually there, the Brooklyn, actually, because behind Brooklyn, the Bush Terminal is the Brooklyn Navy Yard. So all the fabricating, huge fabrication plants, you know, to put together battleships. They built them as Battleship Missouri. People don't know the Battleship Missouri was built over here in Brooklyn, over.
Okay, I went to school a few blocks away from the Brooklyn Navy Yard. I think you're telling me the Red Hook section was adjacent to the Brooklyn Navy Yard. Go ahead.
Basically, you know, that's all that area there. When you went to Pratt Institute, that's a little further over. That's a little further. That's right where I went to school, you know, on DeKalb Avenue. But that's a little bit further over from not... Stone's throw, really, but that's more or less called, where you went to school, was called Fort Greene area, Dick, over.
Red Hook is by where the Belt Parkway goes way up near Governor's Island.
Good to know. And where is it north, south, east, west, Ed, from the Brooklyn Navy Yard?
Further down river on the East River, I'd say mile.
Great, so you know you requested this.
Go ahead, Howie.
What's the track? Where did you live? Did you take two trains to get to your school? Did you get off at DeKalb Avenue or Clinton or Washington?
Clinton, Washington is where I got off. That was the closest stop to the school when I commuted. But I did, some of the periods of time, live on campus. I also lived in the buildings nearby, which were called Willoughby Walks. And eventually Willoughby Walks got purchased by the school and became a dormitory. Back to you, Howie.
Okay. So you live right there to campus. All right, so you can take the 3-2 train from Queens down to the college. I don't know if you know this. A gentleman was going to give a lot of money to the, wanted them to open up an engineering school again. They took his money and they built a dorm. The new dorms were built by a former Double E graduate. You know about that?
What year did he graduate and what's his name?
I don't know his name. I'll speak to someone and get that information from you. This guy gave the school like $15 million to wind up to reopen the school, and I think one of the Pratt's talked to make the building a dorm. You know, Pratt was the only school that was able to build the dorm with the interest that they got from the bank from this guy's money.
Very nice. And, when I was going there, the dorms, there was a dorm on the north side of the library, and there was another dorm on the south side of the library. For a while, the south side dorm, closer to DeKalb, I think it was.
Yeah.
Closer to DeKalb Avenue was the one that was the men's dorm. Closest to one to Myrtle Avenue, I think it was, is the female dorm, the northern one. All of that got changed around when you were there. Is that true?
Absolutely. Where did you guys eat? Did you guys eat in the pizzeria or the deli right up the block right near the train station? And it used to be an art store. I don't know. Maybe it's changed because you went in the 60s and I went in the 70s. And I graduated in 1980 and you graduated in 63, 64. So there's about 14 years difference between us.
Yeah, right at the corner of, let me think now. I would call it the northwest corner of the school. That corner, two streets come together on the northeastern corner there was a stationery store that everybody bought all the materials at. Right across the street from that was a diner. You could eat in the school cafeteria, or you could eat in that diner was the most convenient places. Or you could walk over to Myrtle Avenue. Back to you.
Visualize the place. If you wanted to go to the school diner, you know, the school cafeteria, you walked out of the engineering building and went to your right. It was right of the where the power plant was. And if you wanted to go up towards the diner or towards the up towards the train station, you would go out of the engineering building and go to your left, and then go at an angle. So you would go left. You walk left and then start to move to your right. Am I explaining it correctly, Dick?
Yes, you are. When you walk past the power plant, the DC power plant, you walked into a door that got you either into the cafeteria. The cafeteria, as I remember, was either on the ground floor or in the basement. It was the bottom of where the elevator went. It was where the school cafeteria was. I presume that school cafeteria was still there when you were there. Is that true?
You need to go downstairs. Maybe it did. No. Look, downstairs was some kind of, when I was there, it was some kind of a lounge area and everything. That was the student building.
Okay, we're going to be closed down in 1 minute. This was TechNet number 1194 of the series that began in September of 1982, I think it was. We're coming up to our 26th year of this TechNet. You guys have spent another 4 hours of your life. This time I started off at the right time. Last week I started off at 7 o'clock by mistake. I was a little bit more sure. Bye-bye, you all. Be kind to each other. Mel, K2KEY. Time for you to put on the ribbon.
Mel, good night, Dick. WD3, Stone, you know.
Okay, good night, Howie. All right, well, I'm just going to say one final word. The place that you mentioned that sold all the supplies and all, I still have things. My compass, my drawing stuff angles, and my slide rule and everything, I still have it here, Dick, purchased there. I still use it, believe it or not. Still do my drawings and everything. My drawing board and everything all came from that place. And, okay, everybody, thank you. And all those who went to field day, I hope you had a good time. We'll pick up the emails and everything next week, put everything back the way we do it normally, and see if we can't do it again next week. 73 is all. Take care. This is KCKEY.
KCKEY,
you're 2 years.
Good night.
Rich, how you feeling?
Doing all right, Mel. Before the machine shuts down, you know, I don't get to look at that part of Brooklyn very often, but 27 Field, is there a main road to a, does 27 Field border a, elevated subway or have a reason for asking?
Well, it sits in the middle of nowhere at the end of Brooklyn, the corner of Brooklyn, by Jamaica Bay. Flatbush Avenue, the main street, that's the main drag. You go down Flatbush Avenue, and you're riding line right alongside of Floyd Bennett. If you look on a map, look at Flatbush Avenue, over.
Okay, very good. No, it's somewhere else I was thinking of. All right. Remember an area of Brooklyn by a subway when there was very little people used to fly model airplanes there?
Well, there are several places, but well, you can't get to, there's no way to get to Floyd Bennett by subway. You have to get off the subway and then take a bus. Yeah, sometime you should have come down, Rich. Should have come down. I'll take you around, show you some very interesting things. A phenomenal place to visit. A lot of history there. As Dick will tell you, we really had quite an interesting get-together last year at the one of the hangars. Saw some things that really were fascinating. Okay, you'll have room to repeat it. Good night, all.
Okay, well, maybe one day, still not doing so great, you know. When did they shut down Floyd Bennett? One year, and that was a military base during the war, wasn't it?
And, Mel, did you get a chance to go into the hangar this year?
No, because you didn't show up.
Okay, he wants to know when you closed down Floyd Bennett.
Actually, never closed down. The military, rather, of course, World War II was a training base. The previous, that was the first Air Force in New York City. And then after the Navy pulled out of there, the Coast Guard then ran it, and the police department kept it for their helicopters. And the Coast Guard still was running their coast reconnaissance system from there. So never really shut down. It's just now, hey, maybe it's, of course, the Fox Department took it over.
Yeah, I was wondering, I guess I'll rephrase it. What year did it formally stop being an airport?
It was during the 1930s. When just before World War II, that actually the military came in and took it over and turned it from a more or less a private airport, commercial airport, into a military base. Late 30s, and still got all the.